You are listening to the Plastic Surgery Revolution with Dr. Stephen Davis, the one and only podcast that discusses modern plastic surgery and leaves you looking great and feeling better.
Welcome, everyone, to the Plastic Surgery Revolution. I'm your host, Dr. Stephen Davis. I am so honored to have with us today Dr. Sabrina Fabi. Dr. Fabi is a board-certified dermatologist and an assistant clinical professor at the University of California in San Diego. She is internationally recognized as a leader in the field of cosmetic dermatology, and her practice is in San Diego, California, and the practice is cosmetic laser dermatology. Sabrina, how you doing?
I'm doing as good as I can be given the pandemic that we're presently all facing.
I know. And I really am so excited about having you on the program today because I wanted to hear your perspectives about how you've been, what the practice has been doing, and how you've been doing things ever since we were told out there in California and out here in the Philadelphia, New Jersey area to kind of shut down. What's it been like?
Right. So we had a shelter-in-place order that went into effect March 19th. And so we obviously stopped seeing cosmetic patients as we primarily do 100% cosmetic dermatology procedures, so injectable as well as laser and device procedures.
Right.
In that time, we've, you know, to try to remain connected with our patients, we have done educational webinars so that we can stay in contact with our patients so that they know that, you know, we're still going to be present, you know, once this all resolves. And there are many practices that may not be able to necessarily be sustainable after this economically.
It's true.
And that's been actually quite nice because we've done things anywhere from, you know, jawline recontouring to like reshaping the lower body. And they've, you know, people have, you know, attended, and actually we are seeing more people in attendance just because people are at home at the time. And we've gotten like over 100 people attending these webinars, where historically we only have maybe about 25 or 30 that can actually physically make it into our office to attend when we do these lunch and learns. So we've had a greater reach, and 60% of those patients are actually from outside of our practice, new patients that we've never seen that are attending. So definitely have noticed like a desire and want from just patients who want more education. And we have more time to do that.
I think that's such a major, major thing. I've seen the same thing out this way, where patients have the time, they want to learn more about things that they're interested in. So I think this was a great opportunity for that. What I want to ask you is, when are you guys actually being told that you're going to be allowed to reopen again and start to see patients?
Well, so a lot of dermatologists have continued to remain open just because there are skin cancers that are considered, you know, essential, you know, to treat, especially a melanoma. You can't let that sit for more than a month, you know? Now that we're going into possibly 2 months into this, you know, we're going to potentially start seeing like non-cosmetic, more medical related dermatology, actinic keratoses. We do a lot of laser for that with photodynamic therapy. And then other conditions, you know, if you let acne be so aggressive and you don't do anything, it can start causing scarring. So right now the lines are a bit blurred in that we're not, you know, what is, you know, technically all of what we do, you know, is, I guess, non-essential, you know, like it's not urgent, you know, but these are things that, you know, can have a lot of effects on like the mind and mood of our patients and have a psychosocial impact, you know? So, So it's been interesting navigating through that. I think right now we're not doing laser resurfacing or LiPo procedures, as those are obviously more intensive procedures that could potentially, you know, if there's a complication, could require some type of hospitalization. So we're not doing that. But we're just waiting. Also, there's the medical legal implications. So we're waiting for our medical malpractice carrier to let us know if, you know, if we can see these patients. So yeah. More to come today, yeah. Actually.
Yeah, that's what we're doing here as well. I guess one of the things that I just keep going over with my staff is trying to convey a sense of safety to the patients so that they know that we're doing everything that we possibly can to make their visit to the practice as safe as possible. And whatever treatment that we are going to be allowed to do and start doing again, that it would be delivered in the safest manner possible. Have you implemented anything yet going forward with the practice?
We have a full reopening protocol. So, you know, all employees, not just patients, but employees, you know, are instructed that they shouldn't enter our facility if they have a cough or fever, and they have to maintain a 6-foot distance from one another, and sneeze and cough into like a cloth or tissue, and if not available, into their elbow, and not shake hands or engage in any unnecessary physical contact. To protect our employees, everyone who can carry out work duties from home is being directed to do so. Employees who have not been told not to come in to work if they're sick, you know, and we're doing, you know, temperature checks, even though we know that up to 67% of the time you may be afebrile and have this virus.
I know.
But we're still trying, at least for the 33% of the time, we may be able to catch something,
right?
You know, and if an employee does present with any of these symptoms in clinic or becomes symptomatic after being in the clinic, you know, our practice manager would be notified immediately, and we would take the next steps to, you know, quarantine certain employees. We're doing the best we can to, like, you know, keep a 6-foot distance, you know, between all desks and individual workstations, break rooms, bathrooms. And we have, like, disinfecting, you know, protocols throughout the practice to be done at least 4 times a day. And we have disinfectants and related supplies available to all employees, like, in various locations. And, you know, and making our employees sign this protocol so that, you know, there's an accountability there. And
I think that's very important.
Yeah. So we're doing the best, you know, that we can. Also disinfecting, like, payment portals and pens and styluses after use. We're no really longer having, like, waiting rooms. You know, there's, like, maybe three chairs in a given space that are all 6 feet apart. But we're really having patients call us when they arrive. And then we will text them when they can come up, and we would escort them directly into a patient room so that they're not in an area where other people are. So we're doing our best, you know, also to just remove any communal objects from waiting rooms or exam rooms. And then, of course, we're doing a questionnaire when we do schedule patients, you know, and asking them to reschedule when we schedule them. And then also when we do our follow-up, where we do our phone calls to confirm their appointments the day before, you know, whether they've had a fever, cough, shortness of breath within the 14 days, loss of taste, loss of smell. And we're asking them to bring in their own face mask, but if they don't bring one, then we would obviously provide them with a cloth face mask.
Mm-hmm. Right. I, you know, it's so fascinating to me because I've been on so many webinars and things that the different societies have really joined together to really come up with so many of the similar type of ways to go about handling things. I'm interested to know, you do so much, and I guess the practice is really all cosmetically based. Like, which one of the cosmetic procedures do you feel that you would introduce first, so that if the governor says that everything's really ready to go, let's say by this Friday, and let's say starting next Monday, patients that have really been really chomping at the bit to come in and get their Botox or things like that. Is that one of the first procedures that you see starting in with?
I think that that's probably what most people are missing most during this time, especially if they missed their window like a month ago, you know. I think it's more than just minimizing wrinkles, but it's also, you know, when we relax those muscles, we relax the overlying skin and the skin looks better. And I think patients are now seeing that their skin doesn't look as good, but it's mainly their neuromodulator is not in place. So I predict that that's probably going to be like, we already have our schedule out. I'm booked all of May right now. So just looking at what patients are coming in for, that's probably number one. And injectable fillers are number two. But from the standpoint of, you know, what's probably safest to be doing right now too, you know, body contouring procedures, right? That don't require an injection, that don't require us as doctors to necessarily, you know, put ourselves at risk and be kind of breathing over a patient, are probably going to be what, you know, it would be most ideal. Things like cool sculpting and cool tone. That's presently what we have, especially now that we can't do lipo, you know, and patients are definitely wanting to do something before the summer starts, especially here. Our beaches opened up this past Monday. And so now that we don't have that option, really, and I don't know when we will, I think that that's, you know, something that will probably pick up in demand.
I think so too. I just recently did a webinar about cool sculpting and how I also felt that was going to be probably, if not the safest, one of the procedures that we could start right back in doing. And I think there's so many people that are, especially if they've been home and, you know, self-quarantining, they may have missed the gym a little bit and maybe not worked out as much as they wanted to, and maybe kind of had some foods that they would normally have stayed away from. They may find that getting a little cool tone or a little cool sculpting may be the right position for them to get started with things. I wanted to ask you about injectables, fillers and things like that. From the standpoint of injecting in the perioral area or anywhere around, even in the nasolabial folds, do you feel that that's something that we would have to almost slowly work our way into doing? And when we do it, and you may be wearing the same getup that you will for Botox and things and neuromodulators, but are you going to wear anything different than you would normally have been using before the coronavirus pandemic?
Right. Well, we're also going to be using eye shields. You know, which I usually don't, I don't wear glasses. So we're going to be adding and incorporating that other measure. And we're also, you know, the doctor, all the staff, I've always come in with my work clothes, like my street clothes, you know, and a white coat, and we're not going to be doing that. We're going to change upon arriving to the office. We have a physician changing room into, you know, newly laundered scrubs that we'll be, you know, changing out of at the end of the day and laundering. You know, it's different in that, we're no street clothes, only scrubs, laundered every day, in addition to mask and eye protection.
We're definitely thinking of doing that same thing. Would you engage in, let's say, a lip augmentation, like putting some filler in lips soon, or would you wait a while for any special, I don't even know when the time frame would be where you would start to feel more comfortable to do that. But would that be something that you would start doing relatively soon?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I know things that are close to the mouth, you know, and if do we want to put ourselves in that, you know, with that risk. Obviously we're not going into the news, luckily, but then the question is when. I don't see this going down anytime.
Yes, that's it. Right.
So when is the ideal time to start? You know, I don't think the governor would, you know, open up, you know, salons and other things too, where there's a lot of close proximity, where dentist office, where, you know, like people are literally with their mouth open and breathing on you for at least an hour. If there wasn't the capacity to, if God forbid, you know, there was a resurgence of this, which there's thought that there is going to be, the capacity for our first-line responders and for our ICUs to be able to tolerate, you know, another influx, right? So
right.
Trying to get the numbers down to a point where it could be manageable for our healthcare system. Because the reality is that we don't have a cure for this yet, and we don't have a vaccine. And so the alternative is just, you know, waiting, you know, indefinitely. And I don't know if that's a feasible option if businesses close and people lose their insurance, and the health care implications of that if people don't have the money to be able to take care of themselves and see their doctors also. So, I don't know. There's two sides to the debate when it comes to when is it a good time to open. I don't know if we know.
I know. I don't know if we know either. That's why I thought it was so interesting to just have, you know, even from the San Diego to the New Jersey perspective, it's so obviously similar in that same regard. One of the I'm the chief of plastic surgery of my hospital system out here, and I've been involved in a lot of the emails that go back and forth just from how the hospital system is working and what they're doing to keep everything safe and efficient for the hospital workers, as well as, you know, the physicians that are also going to be bringing elective cases there. But I know one of the things that I've been in an email going back and forth, and I wanted to get your spin on this because I know you guys are such experts in the laser realm. Have you thought about lasers and the plume that it would make? And are there any things that you would do in, let's say, the room itself for the air, or is there anything you guys have come up with that you think is also from a safety standpoint, something that you could, you know, get back into doing all the lasers and things that you do there?
Yes. So right now we are not going to be doing laser resurfacing because, as you know, the degree of plume that we do get from those cases. Obviously, we've always worn an N95 mask to do those procedures. But right now, we don't want to be utilizing those masks when they could be going to our, you know, healthcare responders.
Right.
So I don't know what they're going to do as far as like recycling the air and like putting in filter systems to make sure that, you know, that the residual, you know, the air that the plume that is going up in the air is, you know, is being, you know, drawn in. And we've had these capture systems that we've used before when we've used nitrous for we historically, before we had a before we used the Pronox system, we would use nitrous so that we can do port wine stains. So one of our ORs does have the system to kind of capture. I'm forgetting the exact name of what that system is. Perhaps you can help me if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know,
I know.
To capture that air so that you don't have nitrous blowing all over the clinic, right? So
exactly.
We put them in place in one of our ORs, which is where we do our laser resurfacing. So we luckily have that measure in place, but nevertheless, we're not doing it from the standpoint of utilizing resources that could potentially be going to our first-line responders, which are the N95 masks.
Yeah, same with us. I have recently just purchased one of those air-capturing devices for a few of my exam rooms where we do some of those types of procedures. And it also, I hear, we haven't even gotten it delivered yet, but I hear it has a UV light in it also that's supposed to do something with the air as well.
Minimize the virus. You know, the only thing is that what we don't know is if that viruses, what hasn't been proven, we know that if there's a virus that is found on cardboard or rubber or any type of surface, we know that they have found, and there's many studies to show how long it can last. But no one has actually done any studies to support the transmission occurred from obtaining the virus through a surface. So although it may be detectable on a surface, we don't know if that's necessarily a mode of passing, you know, the disease.
That's true.
Many companies are definitely profiting from selling UV systems. I think it's specifically UVC. But we don't necessarily know what the implications are of any virus found on a surface. I think now it's, you know, we definitely do know that it's through, you know, it's airborne. And most likely, you know, something through the nose, through the mouth is probably more likely, and definitely when touching our face and then with our hand, you know, potentially, you know, to something else. But no one's been able to confirm that what's found on a surface of like a container can actually be enough of a viral load to create disease.
Right. That's true. Sabrina, what I wanted to do is maybe shift gears a little bit, because I know one of the things I've heard you talk about, and I know you're very passionate about, is about achieving like a three-dimensional rejuvenation in people by utilizing different modalities or different types of products. Could you talk about that maybe with body stuff, and maybe give an example of also how you use things like that for the face?
Yeah. So, you know, we've always talked about on the face, you know, it's a three-dimensional structure. You know, people just chase a fold, like a nasolabial fold, and then you can create actually an effacement of that curvature of the face and can actually masculinize a female face. So I always, you know, even tell my residents or fellows, just that because you can doesn't mean you should, right? So just because you can get rid of a fold doesn't mean you should, because you have to be more mindful of like the larger context that that fold is in. It's creating a curvature to the face that might make the face look more feminine. Similar, I'd say, to the body, you know, especially with the buttock and the thighs, you know, as we get older, I always say that a female buttock can start to look more masculine. And so I commonly get women that come in for, let's say, cellulite. And, you know, cellulite is such a broad term for so many people that is almost encompasses many things: excess fat deposition, like a saddlebag, you know, waviness to the skin from skin laxity, dimpling, an irregular skin texture from the dimpling. And then also, you know, the repositioning of fat more to the saddlebag instead of the hip del. And so you lose volume in the hip del. That's a more masculine characteristic. And so it makes the buck look more ptotic. And so when patients come in wanting a cellulite treatment, I always assess the entire, you know, all of the shape of the buttock and thigh, to make sure that there are curvatures that are in alignment with a more feminine, you know, with a they call it like the lazy S shape of the butt. And the skin texture is smooth, not just from a dimple perspective, but from a skin laxity perspective. And so I historically start by reducing fat. So if there's excess fat creating the saddlebag, I typically will reduce the fat there first.
Okay.
Using something like Cool Tone, which is approved for the use on the outer thigh. After about a month there, then I assess if there's volume loss, you know, along the hip del, because if you just reduce that and then you just, and the woman doesn't have like a nice silhouette I guess, more laterally along the buttock, which we start to lose, then that might benefit from a little bit of volume. And so people call it cellulite, but it's like a waviness because of the lack of volume in that space. So you can do fat transfer, you can do off-label injections of Sculptra or dilute Radiesse in that area. And that not only improves the quality of skin, which gets thinner as a function of age, so that you can improve that bit of like skin irregularity, but it also volumizes that area. And then if there's, you know, dimples, I may consider at that same time or like a month later using something like Selfina to perhaps release some of the tethered bands. More recently now we have Cool Tone, which is wonderful because to get that kind of projection, that posterior projection that many patients want, you can utilize Cool Tone using it on the gluteus maximus muscle to kind of create the volume that some people have always had, but also as a function of age, we lose our production. Our production of anabolic hormones decreases. So for men, testosterone, for women as well as progesterone. And so you're no longer able to make the muscle mass that you used to make. And that also contributes to the appearance of a flatter buttock that looks a bit more tonic. So it really requires a combination of these modalities, depending on what the problem is, to get the ideal silhouette that people are really trying to achieve. And so I think it comes down to seeing the right person who's aware of this three-dimensional change, not just going to someone because they offer one particular treatment. I think the art is the assessment.
Well, I love the way you structured that entire assessment and how you would go about treating it. Let me ask you a little bit about biostimulatory procedures, something like a Sculptra that's being used off-label to inject, let's say, in the buttock area. How do you describe to the patients the ability to use something like Sculptra to not only help make the skin look healthier and thicker, but how do you use that to also grow some tissue in the area so that if someone, let's say, doesn't have enough of their own body fat to transfer into the butt region, and that would be more of like a fat transfer type of a thing. If we were going to use Sculptra to do that and to make a little bit more volume there, how do you differentiate between using it maybe more for skin or cellulite versus actually trying to make more volume?
It's depth of injection and where I put it and how much I use. So we know from studies that PLLA, it's not just stimulating new collagen production, but it actually can create an increase in adipocytes in a particular area. And that's where you can get the volume from. Now, it's not necessarily going to create that much adipocyte formation that you get the volume that a fat transfer is going to do. So if you have the person that's ideal, if they're looking for Sculptra as an agent to add volume, first I assess them, of course. What I find is that the people that need the volume are the people that don't have the fat to take it anywhere else.
Right.
I like to use Cool Tone because it's building on your own muscle, the gluteus maximus muscle, if you want more posterior projection, the gluteus medius muscle to almost fill out that hip delt. To see how much of that of your own muscle, someone's own muscle, can be used to create the volume that they're in search of. And then I'll add Sculptra if they don't have the fat to take from anywhere else.
I got you.
Because if you do take the fat, in trying to take the fat, I've seen a lot of people develop irregularities. And then they're met with the distress of that. And then it's a volume issue. You know, how much, you know, if they want volume, then I typically off-label will inject anywhere from 2 to 3 vials per buttock. I know there are people that are doing 20 vials, but the reality is with Sculptra that what we've learned from the face is that if you want more volume, you do more sessions. You don't do more vials. So I'll tell them that they'll need more because their body only has the capacity to biostimulate so much. So I feel like it's a loss of product if you're putting in 20 vials. I'd rather do that over a series of injections.
I think that's perfectly said. I because so many of the patients that I've seen over the past, you know, before the coronavirus, but around here, especially everybody getting ready because it's going to become, see, like in San Diego, you guys have that kind of weather all year round, pretty much. Okay. Here, everybody started getting geared up because, you know, April, May is like the gearing up time because we're finally going to have a summer out here. So that was one of the number one procedures that people were really coming in for, was what we would call something like a Brazilian butt lift, or where we're liposucking an abdomen and love handle and then transferring the fat into the buttock region. Or if someone really, like you said, doesn't really have enough of their own fat, we were using some Sculptra to enhance that area. And it is fascinating because I do see it as a way of using it, as you were saying, if you were injecting it deeper, you're going to try to stimulate more of those adipocytes or fat. And if you're doing it more superficial, you're trying to get more of a skin reaction to look just more youthful, tight, and glowing, if you will. Do you change your dilution if you're going to go deeper to try to get more volumization versus if you're going more superficial?
Yes. I mean, Neil Sadek published on this for volume, using about a 12 cc dilution. But for just the skin change, using about a 16 cc dilution and injecting it more superficially.
Yeah, I think we're kind of starting to see it, that area. And the fascinating part about this for us is now trying to incorporate Cool Tone into the mix. Have you had Cool Tone in your practice for a while?
Yeah, we did participated in the clinical trial for Cool Tone. And so we used the beta systems in June of last year. And then we acquired the new system when it became commercially available earlier this year. And we've had great success because, again, you know, we can only build so much with some of these biostimulators. Many of the patients that can benefit from an augmentation or from more volume tend to be so thin that they have nowhere to take volume from. So in building and strengthening the gluteus maximus and medius muscle, we're able to almost create the shape that they're looking for.
Right. I think I love the way you go about assessing the face and the body and just trying to like hit all the different aspects to get that three-dimensional natural type of a look. Sabrina, I want to ask you one more question here. Like, so after seeing what's transpired over these past 2 to 3 months and all post-COVID-19 situation, how do you see your practice, or for that matter, the practice of cosmetic dermatology changing in the future?
I think that, you know, patients have been affected by this as well. And so perhaps people are not going to be, you know, doing everything like they once were, you know, and addressing everything. I think that we've probably had a little bit of a shift back to a more normal aesthetic, since we don't have a bunch of people posting on all the social media threads, you know, crazy looking lips or, you know, cat eyes. People have been looking at themselves without such filtered versions of themselves, you know, since they're not going out and they're not adding all these filters and they're not doing all this makeup. And so I think that we know that there's a lot of visual adaptation that occurs, you know, based on our visual, you know, like our visual appetite, what we're seeing every single day. And so I think that this time has served as an ability to reset. And so I don't perceive that people are going to be coming in, you know, looking for as much augmentation as historically has been the case. I typically don't see, my aesthetic is a bit more natural, so I typically don't see patients that are looking for 3 syringes into their lips, but they do exist. Yeah. And they've come in for consultations, and I think that type of patient will probably, there will be less of that for now. As people, you know, haven't been aren't seeing that as much, you know, whether it's on TV or whether it's on Instagram or whether it's on, you know, TikTok. People are just not exposed to that right now. So it's allowed for a reset, which is good. With that, I think people are going to be asking for less. And I think economically, people are also going to be in a position where they're not going to be able to do everything either. So it'll be kind of basics, you know. So in my practice specifically, it'll probably be injectable neuromodulators. I see people addressing their skin more, especially now that they've had to face their face every single day at home without makeup. And I get a lot of people messaging me today more than ever, like, what can I do for my skin? What products can I be using? So there's definitely been a shift to that, more awareness of their skin than necessarily all of their volume.
Boy, I think what you just said is a beautiful way to wrap up everything about this entire episode. I think that was perfectly said. I love the way you got into understanding that by not seeing so much of the exaggerated looks on Instagram and all the other social media sites, and understanding this, the severity and the seriousness of what we're all going through. I bet you that is going to be something that people don't ask for as much. I think they may almost feel uncomfortable asking for that because they may see it as an over-the-top use of funds and everything else. I think that was beautifully said. Sabrina, thank you so, so much for being with me today. Any last or final words that you'd like to leave everybody with from beautiful San Diego, California?
Yes, I hope that the rest of the country, you know, also recovers as quickly as we've recovered here, that we don't forget what we've been able to all take away from this time, which is, you know, in all the uncertainty, I think what's important has become more clear, and that might be the blessing of all of this. And so do not lose sight of that as we, you know, pick up the pace. With, you know, our daily lives. I just, you know, for me, that's something that I want to be mindful of moving forward, is to have it have the impact and take away something positive from all of this.
Well, that was beautifully said. Thank you so, so much for being with me today. And for everyone listening, you've been listening to The Plastic Surgery Revolution. I'm your host, Dr. Stephen Davis, and I'll be speaking with you again next week. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to The Plastic Surgery Revolution with Dr. Stephen Davis. Please subscribe to our show in iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or whatever app you use to listen to podcasts. Keep listening, looking great, and feeling better.